Thank you, Mohammed. Is this working? I guess it is. So it's a great pleasure to be invited to come and talk, and I'd like to thank the organizing committee, Siv and Mohammed, for inviting me, and thank you all for coming back here on this lovely day in Toronto. It's got to be 18 degrees out there. It's really, really nice. A bit atypical, but we do have nice weather sometimes in the north. I'm a radiation oncologist, and I spend a lot of time treating patients, and I have a number of academic interests as well that really focus on how we can improve the outcome of our patients receiving radiation treatment. About 40 to 50% of patients with cancer will get radiation treatment at some point during the course of their illness, so it's a very important modality, and ways of optimizing that are really a focus for ongoing research in many centers around the world. And from my perspective, thinking about my patients, there's at least two ways that we can think about doing that. These are not ways that we think of in isolation. They're actually quite integrated. One of them is to really think about the biology of the tumors and the underlying normal tissues that are closely related to these tumors, and try to figure out what separates tumors from the normal tissues, try to understand the biology, and try to target that biology in combination with radiation to actually cure the tumor more effectively without causing side effects or injury to the normal tissues. And that's sort of reflected in the right side of this image here, and we have a number of interests in that area, and I've talked about a lot of aspects relating to the biology of tumors that we see in the clinic on several occasions in this forum, largely related to vascularity and the microenvironment, hypoxia, and more recently metabolism. So I thought today I wouldn't talk about that. Lance, actually, who's following after me, is, I think, going to talk about aspects of the vascularity, which will reflect some of these issues that I might have spoken about here. Instead, I think what I'll talk about today relates to the technology development that's happened in this area over the past 5 to 10 years, and the increased capacity that we have to anatomically target tumors with much greater precision. But with that comes a number of questions, and these answers are now starting to emerge, largely driven by new engineering techniques and the application of mathematical models and methods. And that's depicted on the left side. But as I've said, these are synergistic approaches, and I think the future for patients will be actually combining both of these in ways that make sense. And at the end of the day, what we really want to do is be able to target more precisely radio-resistant regions of tumors, so linking the biology to the anatomical targeting piece. And there's been a real evolution in our ability to more precisely deliver radiation, which is depicted in this slide. This is actually somebody with prostate cancer. These are axial images to the patient, and you can see going back to the 80s, the red area here is the high-dose radiation area, and you can see that in addition to treating that tumor in the center, there was a lot of normal tissue that was treated, which limited our ability to increase the dose, and it also induced side effects in these patients. And there's been this constant evolution down to where we are now, where we're using something called intensity-modulated radiation, which allows us to more precisely deliver this dose in an area around the tumor, and it eliminates a lot of the normal tissues from that volume. And this technique here really involves modulating the fluence of the radiation beam, both spatially and in time, so that we have a lot more flexibility and control, more degrees of freedom in how that dose is delivered. And this is really reflected also in this slide, where we actually deliver a very high dose to the central region where the tumor is. There are very steep dose gradients outward from the tumor, so by the time we're out into some of these normal tissues like the rectum back here, the bladder in the front, the dose is actually very, very low to these normal structures. And this whole concept, which is permeating radiation practice these days, image-guided IMRT, links this kind of dose delivery to onboard imaging. So we have CT scanners, and the trend now is toward integrated MR scanners in the treatment units that allow us to target these tumors very, very precisely. There's a problem with that, though. As we start to get more precise with how we deliver radiation to these tumors, we actually need to be aware of many of the intricacies of how tumors and normal tissues change over time. Tumors and the tissues around them are not stable. They're not stable in any way. Tumors change position, as is shown here. This is actually an MR image of a liver. This is a coronal image of someone with a liver tumor that's right here. This is their liver. And you can see how this thing is bouncing up and down with movement, with breathing. And so if we're trying to target this thing with a very precise radiation volume, it gets very, very tricky. If you miss that from time to time, you're decreasing the likelihood that tumor will be controlled by the treatment that you're trying to implement. So they change in position. They not only change in position, they shrink over the course of treatment. Radiation is often delivered in small daily doses over the course of several weeks. And sometimes the more responsive of these tumors will regress dramatically during that period of time. So that also contributes to change in position or change in volume that you want to treat. Not only do they shift, rotate, translate, shrink, they also morph or change shape quite dramatically during a course of treatment as a result of a combination of those various motions that I've talked about, but also as a result of different forces being applied from different directions. And then, of course, the biology changes dramatically, both de novo and in response to some of these treatments. So if we think about how radiation treatment has evolved over the past many, many years, this is kind of, in some respects, parallels the slide I showed you earlier for prostate cancer. For some time, we adapted only to the initial conditions. So we had some kind of picture of the tumor when we start the radiation treatment. We based the entire treatment on the conditions at the start of treatment, where that tumor is located, how large that tumor is, all those sorts of things. And we go through a process of delivering radiation in this manner. The volumes that we chose to treat were quite large in order to be able to accommodate those kinds of motion changes that I just talked about. And now we're moving down into this sort of an era here, where with the availability of imaging and day-to-day imaging, we can start to think about how we might change how we treat these tumors in a way that allows us to adapt to their motion change or even biology. And this kind of continuum here has led, I think, to some of the things that are illustrated on the right, including an increased dependence on technology and a lot more human input to decide how we actually modulate these treatment plans as we go along. But hopefully, they're going to lead to increased patient survival and decreased side effects. So this just depicts this again. For many years, when we're delivering fractionated radiation treatment, you'd image initial conditions for that tumor at the start of treatment. You generate some kind of a class solution. In other words, the same one size fits all. Every patient gets treated in the same way. You generate a plan based on that, and you deliver treatment. The next step in the evolution was to actually say, well, if we get a picture each day, we can kind of maybe shift this. We'll use the same treatment plan that as before, but we'll just adjust the targeting a little bit. We'll maybe just move the beams a little bit so that we're hitting this tumor if it's changed. And the where we're at right now and what I want to focus on a little bit today is the concept of reimaging not just for position, but for change in the tumor volume, the tumor shape, and everything else. Do that at some interval, perhaps daily, feed that information back here and generate an entirely new plan that optimizes the treatment according to some preset criteria that are in place. Now, what I'm going to talk about, I showed you prostate cancer, but what I spent a lot of time thinking about is cervix cancer, which is still a big problem for women around the world. It's probably the number one cancer worldwide, mostly in underdeveloped countries. We still see an awful lot of it, and it often affects young women who die of their disease. And this is an image of someone that I treated not long ago with cervix cancer. This is an MR image, a sagittal image of this patient, urinary bladder, rectum back here, uterus, and this is the tumor here. These things can be quite large, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 centimeters in size. Now, radiation treatment is very effective for this disease, and we cure an awful lot of women. And this is the same patient about midway through her treatment now, and this disease is largely gone at this point. But some patients are not cured by radiation treatment in the way in which we're doing it now, and there's a real opportunity, I think, to improve cure rates while at the same time reducing side effects. These two images, which are taken about 5 weeks apart, also illustrate a few other things. There's big differences in the bladder volume, the position and size of the rectum, and in how the uterus has moved as the bladder volume has changed, which really just emphasizes the points that I was making earlier, that nothing is stable, particularly in relation to treating these kinds of tumors. A lot of this adaptive work started with prostate cancer in men. Prostate cancer is beautiful for this, for demonstrating proof of concept, because it's basically a sphere that sits in the pelvis, and all you have to treat is a sphere. It doesn't change shape. It doesn't shrink over time during a course of treatment. It does shift around a little bit. So very simple adaptive strategies have worked well in prostate cancer. As we move into something like this, where these tumors are much more dynamic and complex, then it gets much more difficult. And this illustrates what we can now do with IMRT. We have the ability, instead of this kind of thing, which is a very simple plan that delivers dose to the tumor in the center, but also a lot of normal tissues, we can begin to shape these things. And again, this is an IMRT plan for a larger pelvic volume that shows these steep dose gradients the concavity in dose distribution that's possible with IMRT as a result of the increased degrees of freedom that we have. And again, the ability to shape these isodose distributions in really intricate manners around structures that we're interested in the pelvis or elsewhere. So when we start to think about the challenges that we have to face, there are many here. And this is for cervix cancer, but I think the same things apply to any tumor in the body where you start thinking about how these kinds of treatments can be adapted over time. We have to think about, first of all, how we identify the tumor. That's not trivial. When we're dealing with a big volume, a shotgun approach to treating these tumors, it doesn't matter if the oncologist is 100% certain about where that tumor is actually situated. But as soon as you start getting very, very precise, as a physician, I have to actually be equally precise or at least relatively certain about where that tumor is likely to be, and not only where the gross tumor is, but where the microscopic cancer cells are likely to be, those cells which I can't see on CT or MRI or PET scan these days. We have to think about how these volumes may be very complex and not easily. They're not spheres anymore that we're dealing with. They're very complex volume, the motion issues, the regression and deformation issues. And also, if a tumor shrinks during a course of treatment, what does that mean? Does that mean it's gone? So if you have a big tumor, it shrinks down. Does that mean we can shrink the radiation volume? Just because the visible tumor has shrunk, there could be cancer cells sitting out in that space where that tumor was originally, and by shrinking that volume, we actually could be under-treating that patient. So there's a whole area or a whole domain there of modeling, I think, for example, that might help to tell us how we deal with these things. And we're really in the dark with pushing forward with some of these areas right now in the clinical sphere, and some of this will become clear over time. And of course, there's huge workload issues here because there's a lot more human input, as I mentioned before, in terms of how we re-image these patients, replan these images, and all the quality assurance that goes along with it. And the interest in this field is exploding right now, and these are a bunch of papers that are in the literature just over the past year or so, I think, two from our place, actually looking at some of these issues in relation to cervix cancer, and all of these, in fact, reflect cervix cancer, but there's an equal number for just about any tumor site that you can think of. Most commonly head and neck cancer, that would be another site that is commonly being explored. So we undertook to look at this a few years ago. Philip Chan, who was one of our residents at that time, one of our fellows at that time, put together a study that said, we're going to do MRI scans every week on patients receiving radiation treatment for cervix cancer. And the weekly sequence was meant to essentially sample the movement that might occur, or the position of these structures between fractions of radiation treatment. Ideally, we would have liked to do these studies every day, but that's not practical, so we did it every week, and essentially it's a sampling thing. But we scanned them for 30 minutes virtually continuously, which gives us an indication of the changes that might occur not just between fractions of radiation, but over the course of a fraction of treatment while a patient's laying on the treatment couch. And this is an example of the kind of regression that we see in many of these tumors. So these are the same acts. This is the same patient, different time points, pre-treatment, after 8 gray of radiation, 20, 28, 38, 48. This is pretty much near the end of the first phase of their treatment. And the red shows the tumor volume and this is the tumor prior to treatment. And you can see it certainly by week 3 or so starting to shrink. And on average, in our patient population, these things are down to 20% of their volume by this point in time, after 5 weeks of treatment, 20% of the volume that we start with. And that has big implications for what happens to the anatomy around them and how these structures change in position in relation to one another. So this kind of shrinkage, which doesn't happen in prostate cancer, is a big deal in cervix cancer and head and neck cancer and other tumors. The other thing that these, if I can get this to work here, we're actually to generate these kind of images showing the motion that happens. So this is week 1, and this is week 3. You can actually see some anatomical differences here in terms of the position of the uterus and bladder filling. Bladder filling tends to diminish over the course of treatment because of irritation. But you can also see even what happens during a course of radiation treatment while they're lying on the bed over a 30-minute treatment span. The bladder fills, the uterus pushes up, the air in the rectum behind here changes and moves around a little bit. And all of these act as forces that can push these structures around. So Philip actually then went on, after gathering all this information in about 20 patients, we're up to about 60 patients now with this study, but he actually just did point analyses, looked at 3 points along the length of the uterus here, one up near the top, one down near the cervix, and one at midpoint, and track the motion of these structures over the course of treatment, both intrafraction and interfractional, in relation to a couple of bony, fixed bony landmarks that are indicated there. And the kind, this is sort of a summary that, that Philip published a couple of years ago that shows that in terms of the interfraction motion, there's quite a bit of motion of the top of the uterus here. It can move up to 4 centimeters between fractions on average, and not quite so much in the anterior-posterior direction. The cervix moves a little bit less, but still quite substantial. The intrafraction motion is much less. It's a fraction of what happens between fractions. And the message that we took away from this is that if we want to actually treat these patients with highly focused radiation, you need to actually image them every day and somehow deal with these changes. You can't just take a plan that you've developed on day one and assign it to the patient at each point in time and expect that you're going to get good coverage of these structures. That probably these kinds of this kind of motion that happens while the patient is lying on the couch is reasonably accommodated within some margins that we could plan, that we could incorporate into the plan up front. So the results of Philip's studies sort of reinforce the fact that cervix cancer has very complex spatially dependent motion. Different parts of the volume that we have to treat change in different ways over time and spatially, so some parts of that structure will move differently than others. There's large interfraction tumor motion. There's a small but still potentially significant motion while the patient's lying on the couch. And they tend to regress and deform over time, these tumors. And that had, we thought, important implications. But what Philip didn't look at was what actually are the implications, the dosimetric implications of those kinds of changes. Do they actually matter at the end of the day? We believe they would because the changes are quite large. But he actually didn't look to see how those changes would impact on the dose that's actually delivered to the structures that we're interested in. And that's this question here. So Karen Lim came along, who was another one of our fellows. Both Philip and Karen were from Australia, actually. We have a string of people from Australia. And she actually took up this problem and set out to actually determine in those 20 patients, and as I said, now we're up to 50 or so, to determine how those movement issues over time would start to impact the dose actually received by the tumor and the critical normal structures that contribute to side effects. And Karen also didn't just rely on those point estimates any longer, so she didn't calculate doses to points. She began looking at volumes, which are much more relevant. So she spent a lot of time defining what were relevant volumes in the pelvis that needed to be treated, and then she started looking at how the dose is distributed to those volumes, not just to a few points. So she took it to the next level in terms of the analysis methods. And she looked at it for a conventional radiation plan, for a plan that has a very big margin, 2-centimeter margin, and a plan that has a very small margin, 5-millimeter margin, around what we thought needed to be treated. And her hypothesis when she started out was that this would do a reasonable job, very comparable to what we've been doing conventionally. These big margins would allow lots of room for motion and things to shift around, but that the 5-millimeter plan would fail miserably because the tumor would be shifting in and out of that volume. It required a couple of tools, software tools, that we have implemented as research tools. One is a finite element deformable modeling program. In order to actually track these changes over time, you need to have some way of measuring how these organs are changing in shape, size, and position. And one of the best ways to do that is with this kind of a tool. The one we're using is an in-house product that Christy Brock developed called Morpheus, which actually assigns surface meshes to all of the anatomical structures that we're interested in. So here, for example, at the planning stage, the bladder and the rectum, that's the uterus and the cervical tumors down here, all are the contours that the oncologist puts on there are all converted into surface meshes. The surface meshes are then applied on each of the weekly MRI scans, and then each of these weekly scans are morphed back to the planning state on the basis of the biomechanical properties of the soft tissues that are involved here. So what this allows one to say is to take any little volumetric bit of tissue here on week 5 and convert that, the position of that tissue on week 5 back to the position at the time of planning. So you can actually track how these organs are changing in a much more detailed manner. And the reason for doing that is we want to know if the dose that's actually delivered to each volumetric tissue in that volume. So a little bit of the bladder here that gets a dose on week 5, how does that relate to what the bladder got on the bladder got on week one, or what we intended the bladder to get, by actually knowing how to change the position, how these things have changed over time, and then morphing them back to the position at the time of planning. You can track the accumulated dose to each little volumetric segment of those structures as a function of time. And that was a second bit of software that we have a commercial collaboration with a group in Sweden that's built this software called Orbit that allows us to do dose accumulation over time. And so you can see these maps here on week one. The red orange area is the high dose area that's meant to be encompassing the tumors in the center here. You can see that it's largely well encompassed on week one, but that by the time you're at week five here, the uterus has slipped forward into this area where it's colder, it's getting underdosed a little bit, the rectum has moved forward into the high dose area, so it's getting overdosed. And you can generate these composite difference maps at the end of the day that actually describe the dose that's delivered to the tumor as a function of time, not just the dose that we think we were delivering or prescribed up front. And this is an example of two patients that came out of this analysis. So case one, you can see the red-orange area here, which is this high-dose region again. The tumor basically is outlined in orange here, right there, the volume that was meant to be treated. And you can see that 2 weeks later, the whole thing has shifted. So the tumor has shifted posteriorly. The high dose volume is still here. The bladder is getting more dose than it was supposed to, but the tumor is being substantially underdosed on week two. Here's a second example. In this particular patient, the tumor volume was huge, this red thing here, well encompassed at the time of planning. But by week four, the tumor has shrunk way down. It's this thing here. So it's still getting very well treated, but what we've actually also done is treat a huge proportion of the bladder to a much higher dose. So this is the kind of patient who we might anticipate would fail, have a recurrence of their cancer after completing treatment. This is the kind of patient whose cancer might be well controlled, but they're likely to get a big side effect, a big fistula or something happening with their bladder. And when Karen looked at this across the spectrum, just look at this volume here, which is the most relevant volume in relation to how treatment is delivered. For a conventional plan, everything was very tight. We were treating the tumor very, very well. This is tumor coverage now. The mean doses are not significantly different. This is what was planned. This was what was actually delivered to the patient. As we move the margin to larger sizes, there is some reduction in dose and there's a greater spread in actually what was delivered to the patients relative to what we planned to deliver. But for the small margin plan, you see this effect much more markedly. So there's a further reduction in the mean dose to the tumor across those patients, but the spread of dose variability is also much greater, suggesting that this motion actually is starting to have an impact. What was really surprising to us, though, is that if we establish what we think is a clinically relevant threshold of 95% of the prescribed dose, in other words, most oncologists would accept the fact that there'll be some variation in dose over a course of treatment, but as long as that reduction is less than 5%, most people would accept that as being reasonable. There was only one patient, despite these very small margins, who fell below that 95% threshold. And I think there are various reasons for why that happened. It was against what we had originally hypothesized, but in retrospect, there are many reasons why that could have occurred, and we can talk about those later if we want. And she also looked at what happens with the rectum, the sigmoid, and the bladder, the same kind of an arrangement. And if you just look at bladder, you see with the four-field box plan, there's the delivered dose and the planned dose are pretty much what we were, are pretty much the same. A big proportion of the bladder gets a high dose. As you go to the small margin plan, you get more sparing of the bladder and more sparing of critical normal structures in general. So the hypothesis that she had put forth initially seemed to bear out in that we would actually get some reduction in tumor dose as a result of these small margins, although not as much as what we had anticipated, but we actually do spare normal tissues. So we reduce the dose to these normal tissues, and the expectation of that is that we will reduce side effects for these patients. The problem with all of that is that we can map out the kinds of motion that happen in these tumors. The problem really is that there's unpredictable things. These are patients, nothing's predictable. So despite knowing reasonably well what happens on average in patients, there can be very unpredictable changes. So this is the same patient, a week or so apart, the uterus is here, and look what's happened over here. The uterus is flipped entirely. It's flipped by 90 degrees. So if you wanted to build a plan up front that tries to encompass this. First of all, the small margin or the large margin plan would have failed dramatically. Even our conventional radiation techniques over the years probably would have missed this. It's a dramatic sort of motion. But the implication of this kind of motion is that we get these extreme, complex, and unpredictable things happening, and they're very hard to accommodate in conventional plans. But and it really speaks to the need for daily image guidance in these patients. In other words, taking a picture every day and then doing an adaptive replan based on the anatomy on days when it's changed substantially. So we had another student working with us, James Stewart, who I don't know if James here, he was registered for the meeting. Oh, there he is, James is here, good. Who actually took this forward and actually looked at the concept of doing an adaptive replan for these patients, where he, first of all, just took an IMRT approach with a uniform 3-millimeter margin with no replanning, and he compared that to an automated replan where for every available imaging data point that we had, the patient was replanned to accommodate the new anatomy. And what James was able to show is what we thought would happen. So this is the planned distribution to this tumor target volume, the clinical target volume. Again, very very tight distribution. So what we actually succeeded in planning. If you don't do a replan for these patients, though, and you actually deliver that dose, you get a wide variation, quite a different distribution in relation to what we planned in terms of what we actually delivered to the patient. And with a 3-millimeter margin, 9 of the 33 patients fell below that 95% threshold. So we were underdosing a substantial proportion of these patients with that kind of a margin. But with the replanning philosophy in place, it corrects everything back up to where we want to be. And a similar thing happened with normal tissue toxicity, and what I'm really only going to show here is bladder. So this is the planned dose to the bladder. This is without a replan. You get this wide variation. So a bunch of patients had very high doses to the bladders, much higher doses than what we had planned them to receive. And when you replan, you actually compress that distribution back down again to what we thought we were delivering in the first place. So hopefully these kinds of things will continue to evolve and move forward. So in summary, I'm almost done. I've shown you data for cervix cancer. I think that what we can say about this is very general, though, and that is that tumors move, they shrink, and they change in shape. They're not stable in any way. There can be these very extreme, unpredictable anatomical changes that as physicians or oncologists, you just don't know are going to happen in advance. In order to accommodate these two things, you would need large safety margins around the tumor in order to account for these shifts and these changes and minimize the risk that you're going to miss the tumor during a part of treatment and therefore undertreat that patient. You can probably use smaller margins if you incorporate some of the strategies that we've just talked about. So daily imaging of these patients with replanning as necessary to be sure that you're hitting what you want to hit. And there's a whole bunch of opportunities for research. I've alluded to a couple of them as we've gone along here, but there's lots of questions that this whole area brings up, including how we get good quality images on a day-by-day basis, how we actually get these things contoured in real time, because now this patient's laying on the bed, you've positioned her or him, if you're talking about another tumor site, you've scanned them, the oncologist has to be there to actually draw all those contours again, then it has to be replanned, and the quality assurance checks done, and the treatment implemented while the patient is laying there. So there's a real time pressure that comes into place. And the other thing that's missing that we hope will come out of all of this as we move forward is clinical validation, because we can talk about all this stuff all we want, but if we don't know at the end of the day that these kinds of changes translate into improved outcome for our patients, if we can't measure them, then in many respects it's all academic. I also want to mention that I think the ultimate goal or the ultimate aim here is biologic adaptation. So I've talked about anatomic, but where we really want to be is imaging, for example, changes in tumor biology on a day-by-day basis and trying to accommodate treatment plans or to perhaps radio-resistant regions of tumors. The last thing is I want to put in a plug for the Ontario Consortium for Adaptive Interventions in Radiation Oncology. For anybody who's interested or our students are interested or postdocs, this is a new opportunity that has only recently been funded by the Ontario Research Fund. It's an alliance of 7 Ontario academic institutions. There's a multi-million-dollar award to support this kind of development in Ontario. And the research themes are sort of relating to the things that we've just talked about here. So 3D and 4D imaging for adaptive, some of the processes involved in how you do this in a very practical way and maintain patient throughput, validation of imaging, deformation, and dose accumulation techniques. So how do we know when we do those deformation models that what we think is happening is actually really happening? And then software development to allow this to translate into clinical practice. So thank you very much. There's a lot of people have contributed to this work at our place, including Karen Lim and Philip Chan and James Stewart, who were involved in the studies that I showed you, and I'm happy to answer questions.